What do you discover when you read the private letters of someone who spent decades crafting public fiction? Something unexpected. The raw scaffolding behind the polished prose, the doubt beneath the confidence, the ordinary human struggling to pay bills while creating extraordinary art. Kurt Vonnegut's correspondence, spanning 6 decades, reveals a man who survived the Dresden firebombing, wrestled with publishers, raised 6 children, battled depression, and somehow found time to become one of America's most beloved writers. These aren't carefully composed essays meant for posterity. They're urgent notes to friends, desperate pitches to editors, tender words to children, and occasionally profane rants about censors. Together, they form a mosaic more complete than any biography could offer, showing us not just what Vonnegut wrote, but who he was when the typewriter fell silent. Kurt Vonnegut inherited a legacy before he could walk. His great-grandfather Clemens arrived from Germany in 1848, establishing a hardware empire and founding Indianapolis's Freethinkers Society. His grandfather Bernard and father Kurt Sr. designed buildings still standing across the city. Then the Depression hit. Young Kurt transferred from private to public school, a transition his mother mourned, but which he embraced. The family stopped speaking German during World War I's anti-German hysteria, severing Kurt from his linguistic roots. World War II delivered the cruelest irony. Captured during the Battle of the Bulge, Vonnegut was shipped to Dresden as a prisoner of war. On February 13, 1945, Allied bombers turned the Baroque city into an inferno. He survived only because he was locked in an underground meat locker, Slaughterhouse 5. His first letter home dripped with dark humor. The bombing killed 250,000 people in 24 hours and destroyed all of Dresden, possibly the world's most beautiful city. But not me. That final phrase contains multitudes. Survivor's guilt, mordant wit, the absurdity of chance. This experience would haunt him for decades before emerging as his masterpiece. Throughout the 1950s, Vonnegut wrote at night after working public relations at General Electric, collecting rejections while pitching desperate schemes, atomic bow ties, board games, even a car dealership. In a 1957 letter to his uncle Alex, he described his finances as like the proverbial fart in a windstorm, colorful language masking real desperation. The publishing world was merciless. Scribner's held his Cat's Cradle manuscript for 26 months. Magazines sent contradictory feedback. Too literary, too commercial, too strange, too conventional. Meanwhile, he supported 6 children, including 3 adopted nephews after his sister Alice's death. In 1965, the Iowa Writers' Workshop hired him as an emergency replacement. Despite terrible pay, Iowa City proved transformative. He befriended Richard Yates and Nelson Algren, both brilliant writers who understood struggle. His students Gail Godwin, John Irving, Andre Dubus, later described his teaching as refreshingly honest. He taught them what he was still learning. Good writing serves the reader, not the writer's ego.
Seymour Lawrence discovered Vonnegut through a witty dictionary review in the New York Times Book Review. When Vonnegut left Iowa with a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1967, he approached Lawrence with his unfinished Dresden manuscript, candidly admitting his previous books had sold poorly. Lawrence offered something unprecedented, a 3-book contract covering both hardcover and paperback rights. Slaughterhouse 5 hit bookstores in March 1969, landing in a cultural moment primed for its message. With the My Lai massacre freshly revealed and secret bombings in Cambodia and Laos, Vonnegut's meditation on the Dresden firebombing resonated powerfully. The counterculture embraced his experimental style, anti-war stance, and time-bending Tralfamadorians. The struggling writer became a literary celebrity. Success brought complications. His 25-year marriage to Jane was collapsing. He confessed to his editor of revulsion to Cape Cod despite loving his family deeply. When photographer Jill Kremenz arrived to document his play Happy Birthday, Wanda June, their professional relationship evolved into romance. They married in 1979 and settled in Sagaponack, Long Island, joining a literary enclave that included James Jones, Irwin Shaw, and Truman Capote. The 1980s brought artistic expansion. Vonnegut finally embraced the visual creativity running through his family, his architect grandfather and father, his artist sister and daughters. His 1980 debut at Margot Faden Galleries surprised visitors with its quality, selling 21 pieces at $400 each in his distinctively minimalist yet expressive style. This visual practice became vital when writing proved emotionally draining. He wrote a children's book reimagining the Nativity and, after finding Andrew Lloyd Webber's 1985 Requiem Mass terrible and sadistic, wrote his own humanist version that premiered with a Unitarian choir in Buffalo, perfectly bridging secular humanism with traditional religious forms. Despite these diversions, he published 5 novels during the decade, yet it also brought devastating losses, a serious 1984 hospitalization following an overdose, the deaths of several close writer friends, and, most painfully, Jane's death from cancer in 1986. Throughout these trials, he championed writers' rights through pen, advocating for imprisoned writers worldwide and fighting censorship with characteristic wit. When his books were burned and banned, he penned a scathing New York Times piece describing censors as orangutans needing remedial First Amendment education. After witnessing Mozambique's suffering in 1989, Vonnegut struggled with writing, feeling he'd said absolutely everything. He published Hocus Pocus, 1990, Fate's Worse Than Death, 1991, and Timequake, 1997, but found renewed expression through silkscreen prints with Joe Petro III. A 2000 fire hospitalized him. After recovery, he moved to Northampton, Massachusetts, taught at Smith College, and exhibited artwork. Though creatively spent, the Bush administration drove him back to writing. His In These Times essays became the best-selling A Man Without a Country, offering his enduring message, "God damn it, you've got to be kind." His final letters reveal remarkable self-awareness. In 2007, he declined a Cornell invitation, describing himself at 84 as resembling an iguana, hating travel, and having nothing to say. He died on April 11, 2007, after a fall, leaving a legacy preserved through the Vonnegut Museum and Library and his enduring popularity among young readers. Vonnegut's letters reveal his distinctive process. In 1990, he described his style as lower class, intuitive, moody, and anxious to hold the attention of a potentially hostile audience, with a jazz-like tendency to shift subjects quickly. Bob and Ray comedy tapes gave him permission to be intelligently ridiculous, breaking a 2-year creative block. His advice was practical: seek real experiences rather than television's illusion of experiences. He urged embracing immediate surroundings. The secret of universality is provincialism. Don't open a window and make love to the world. Indianapolis and Dresden became vehicles for universal themes through this philosophy. His primary lesson focused on sociability. Please, please, please make sure the reader is having an interesting time, and the hell with you. This influenced everything from sentence structure to time jumps and recurring characters. Despite fame, Vonnegut remained deeply connected to family, friends, and readers, valuing kindness above all. His message remains radical: be kind, question authority, find humor in darkness, and never stop fighting for what matters. That's not just a literary legacy, it's a blueprint for being human.